Sam Levin calls in with a special iPhone SDK report from Apple. We interview Corey Johnson from Mariner Software. John Nemo returns with a Book Bites Live interview, plus Lee, David, Guy, and me, Tim Robertson. It's My Mac Podcast number 174.
The next generation of radio. It's the MyMac.com Podcast.
And at the Apple event today was Sam Levin, and Sam's joining us via his iPhone on the highway in the car. Hi, Sam.
Hi, guys.
I just want to make sure you're driving safely. We don't want to get in any accidents simply because you're talking on the podcast while driving a car.
No, my hands, well, one of them is on the steering wheel. The other one is on the iPhone.
Sounds pretty good. I mean, you're on the highway driving down the road talking on your iPhone. And the audio quality is not bad at all.
Not bad. You know, I'm surprised how clean it is on your end. You're talking from Skype.
Skype's a wonderful technology when it works right.
Yeah, I know. It has to be good broadband, I guess, and a good mic. So
there you go. That does help.
Yeah.
Speaking of wonderful technology, you got a really good demonstration thanks to Steve Jobs and Apple Incorporated today, eh?
Right. I was invited to the SDK event for the iPhone. And by the way, it's not just the iPhone, it's the iPod Touch as well.
Yes, exactly.
So Apple showed off their wares and tears of the SDK that they unveiled officially. It'll be finished, or the products will be finished probably by late June, or maybe that coincides with WWDC, I'm not really sure, but and what I mean by finished, well, we could start with what the SDK means. It means that engineers and developers can develop applications to run on the iPhone, such as enterprise-class applications, utilities, and gaming applications.
And, of course, these are actually applications. These are not web-centric applications.
These are real applications that are embedded, you know, just like a running your contacts on your iPhone. It's embedded inside. And, you know, before we had to do things like use jailbreak and actually void the warranty, and sometimes it actually messed up your iPhone. So at this time, you don't have to do any of that. It's all deemed kosher by Apple. It's really, really well done how you can create applications very fast. They give you a runtime, I don't know what they called it again, but basically they show you the iPhone on your Mac when you're developing, real time. So it's just right there in front of you, and while you're developing stuff, you can see it on the Mac. So it's
you can see the performance, yeah.
So it shows you, it will record all that as well, kind of like Automator, but it's a full SDK kit. And they brought in people from around the industry. I guess we could start off with the first is the enterprise class applications. They realized if they wanted to be with the big boys, that's all the people that have been using BlackBerries, those are all enterprise class products. Well, Apple was pretty much missing out on that because it wasn't push technology, such as push email, push calendaring. Now, they've got it. They've licensed Microsoft Exchange Server.
Did that surprise you?
No, not at all, because that's what corporate America uses. And so what are they going to do? Recreate Exchange Server? So they licensed that. They are using that for their push technology. Companies around the world love it. Salesforce is one of those companies. That's a Salesforce automation product, and that's web-centric as well, but they love that. There's a pharmaceutical company that can really incorporate Apple's SDK for enterprise-class solutions. They showed it live, running right there, right on stage. It all works. It's all seamless. So they showed an iPhone that has no calendar, no contacts, nothing. and in a touch of a button, the exchange server populated the iPhone. This is all wirelessly in like seconds.
So it is true push technology. It's no
it's
more.
It's true push. This is it. I mean, it's so well done. It's hard to explain it until you see it, how well done it is.
Many of the people that's actually listening to the podcast have watched it. I actually watched it about 2 hours ago. Apple was really quick to get that online.
Right.
What was the attitude or the atmosphere there? How did it feel to actually be sitting at the Apple campus for the demonstration? Because, yeah, we could watch it in a quick time, but that's a lot different as far as atmosphere goes. What's it like to go to Apple to one of these events?
It's great. It's a very small. They call it the town hall, a town hall meeting, because it's in a small conference setting. It's like a stage, so it's a small theater. Steve Jobs was up there. I was, you know, maybe 20 feet from him. There's maybe 300 people. So this is the venue is small. There's select editors and media people from everywhere. You know, San Jose Mercury News, Chronicle, CNET, the standard.
MyMac.com now.
CoolMac Picks, and MyMac, since I'm on MyMac now. So, it's great, and I guess let me finish up with the SDK. I think one of the coolest things was the gaming aspect. Now, we know that right now you can't play any games on an iPhone, I mean, application-wise, maybe web-based, but as an app, there is no such thing on an iPhone.
Right.
Well, the SDK changes the playing field, and what I say is that gaming will now change, mobile gaming will be changed from now on, like the iPod changed music and MP3 players. It will be that big of a deal for a couple reasons. One, they're incorporating OpenGL technology. That's a great graphics engine that's built into the Mac. Now
right.
They have OpenGL 2D on the iPhone and iPod Touch. And then second, they have accelerometers. It's an accelerometer built into the iPod and iPod Touch and iPhone. And what that allows you to do, if anyone knows what they've been doing with their iPhone, is taking photos, turning in landscape mode, the same with Safari browser. So that's called an accelerometer. So now they've incorporated that into gaming. So they showed Electronic Arts came up on stage, one other company did. They had 2 weeks to do something from scratch. They never did anything with Apple's SDK, and they created a game. It was phenomenal, Tim. They were able to use the iPhone or iPod Touch as a joystick. So
wow.
You could move Donkey Kong, if you will. They were using a monkey ball, super monkey
yeah.
ball. I mean, hilarious. And basically, you're moving the iPhone around up, down, left, right, and that's what's moving the character. And it absolutely is going to change how people are creating, gaming, especially mobile games. And then also, Apple's going to be the distribution vehicle for developers to offer their games and utilities. There's going to be an app that will be built into the iPhone. It's going to be an upgrade with a 2.0 firmware upgrade that Apple will distribute. And developers get 70% of the revenue. Apple gets 30. But Apple does everything. They host it. They take care of all the credit card issues. It's really well done.
And what's really surprised me is that as an iPhone user, I'll be able to download any of these applications on the iPhone itself. I don't necessarily have to go through to iTunes to get the stuff. It's right there on the phone.
You can do it two ways. You can do it from iTunes. This you've done before with the games on your iPod or movies. Or you do it wirelessly over the air. You just hit the app button, and it automatically, it'll tell you if there's an update, if you've bought something and there's an update to your game, a little number comes up. Just like on the calendar, what does that as well? Email
oh,
on the
email.
Bottom dock.
Yeah, it has like a number one, and you got
right.
one new message.
It's just that there's an update. You click on that. It tells you, do you want to update it? It gives you the information. One click, one push, it's done. I think it's going to change the economy for mobile gaming. Kleiner Perkins feels so strongly that they've got a $100 million fund that they call iFund specifically for iPhone gaming developers.
I think that's very significant.
It's very significant. And then at the end, Steve Jobs said, hey, for all you media people and press, can you hang around? Just hang around a bit. So I did. I sat in the front row next to Tim Cook of Apple. I believe, isn't he COO? I believe he is.
Yes.
Anyway.
Yep.
And sat next to him, and Steve Jobs and Schiller and another individual, Greg, I forgot, Scott Forstall, the senior director for iPhone development. They were on stage, and they just fielded questions from anyone about anything.
Wow, that's amazing. You don't usually get that opportunity with Steve Jobs and company.
No, you don't. I took a photo. What I'll do is I'll send it to you, Tim. You can post it. I figured I needed to take it with the iPhone, so I took it one photo of the three of them sitting on stage about 6 feet in front of me, so I figured that'll accompany this this podcast.
Absolutely. Send it over. We'll make that the album art for this podcast, Sam.
Perfect.
So I need it within the next couple hours. Get it to me.
I can email it from my iPhone.
Isn't that awesome?
What an amazing thing.
It is. That is technology in the iPhone that I really, really like, being able to take a picture and immediately emailing it to someone. That's great. Well, Sam, I wanted to thank you very much for coming on the show this week and talking about the Apple SDK event and the Enterprise Roadmap. It's really interesting technology. I think it's going to change everything for Apple and us as iPhone users. I don't know about you, but I'm super excited about being an iPhone user right now. Aren't you?
I am too, but you wait. In a year from now, it's going to be even bigger.
It's going to be even bigger. Thanks a lot, Sam. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks a lot, folks.
Consider this promo a controlled substance. Only one drug can bring the visceral and the sublime together in a single trip. Where the best and the worst of the human drive boils down into a techno-art concoction that's half street-level heaven and half the fiery beauty of hell. From Matt Wallace, Parsec award-winning author of The Failed Cities Monologues, this is The Next Fix. Kick back to the strains of Earth's Last Top 40 as the final human DJ sends a shout-out over The Last Frequency. Step into the hard-boiled beauty of the Lusting Corridor, where that which once escaped a man is met again. Tool up with a lone cop who polices the terrifying carrion underground of the future as you seek the end of flesh. Experience one of the most unique and captivating imaginations in fiction today, collected for the first time anywhere in print and featuring 12 original stories and one full-length novella, The Next Fix by Matt Wallace. Pre-order your copy today in limited edition hardcover from apexbookcompany.com and have it personally inscribed by the author himself. Are you ready for The Next Fix?
Hi there, we're back with the My Mac podcast. This is David Cohen. I'm joined by Tim Robertson. Hi, Tim.
Hi, David. How are you today?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. I see Guy Searle's got us in Skype as well.
He has. Where? And we're also, well, wherever you want it to be, Guy.
I didn't even catch that. You dropped out.
You dropped out. It looks like we're going to have the same problems that we had last week with you, David, but let's soldier on. Maybe your connection will get better.
Right.
You never know. It's a weird thing. I think the UK is replacing other copper wire or something, and they keep dropping you out.
Maybe we're on Pakistan's YouTube list this week. But we're also joined by, Corey Johnson of Mariner Software. Hiya, Corey.
Hi, David.
And
so Mariner Software is, you guys have been around a while now, haven't you?
Yeah.
17 years.
Yeah, it's a long time for Mac software development.
Absolutely. So you guys started with the Mac, or did you guys start with an Apple?
Started with Mac, yeah.
And what I was interested to find when I was looking up Mariner software was that I was familiar with the Mariner Write word processor you do, but I didn't realize you had all these other software applications as well. So do you want to just run through exactly what it is you do in terms of the software apps you sell?
Certainly. The software apps really began with Mariner Write and Mariner Calc, which is a word processor and spreadsheet. Those have illustrious pasts. The spreadsheet was actually developed for the Japanese market and was sold bundled along with WordPerfect. And Write was developed also for the Japanese market originally. This is way back in a long time ago, 89, 90.
Like the System 6 days.
Yeah. And so, they handled vertical text and things that a lot of the other applications at the time, you know, some of the Microsoft apps couldn't handle. So from there, that's kind of been our stalwart, products. But, we've branched into the creative, writing spaces. And so we have, such products as Mac Journal, which is journaling and blogging, also does podcasting and now, vlogging or video logging.
Oh, that's interesting.
And then we've also added a screenwriting product called Montage. And
you find a lot of people using that, the wannabes. I have the perfect script. All I need is the right tool to get this down.
They're, the majority of our customers are, everyone has an idea for a movie. So, but
I know I do.
Montage is really cool because, you know, the concept behind it was basically, let's not do an app that just has a typewriter metaphor. Let's actually take the writer through the entire writing process, through pre-writing all the way to getting their script sold. So like right in Montage, you can do all your pre-writing and go from an outline-based, structure-based writing approach all the way to we include the contacts and the people that integrate with your Apple address book to actually send your script off to be read and hopefully purchased or optioned.
Would they need a copy of the software to it, or does it send it as more of a universal, anybody can open this document if you send it to someone?
Yeah, most people would send their scripts in a PDF format. Mm-hmm. But a lot of the major studios and things are accepting Montage file format since we're doing so well in that.
That's always good.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's only $139, $140.
Yes. It's a lot less. It's more aggressively priced than the competition. I mean, for years it's been Final Draft and maybe Movie Magic Screenwriter. And,
but those are pricey. I mean, there was an entry to barrier there that a lot of aspiring writers weren't willing to pay. So they were kind of soldiering through with, a text editor, and it didn't always look very professional.
Right. Definitely. Especially in that industry, formatting is super important. It was our customers that came to us and kept requesting that product, saying, I'm trying to use your products to do screenwriting. Please let me out of Final Draft or Movie Magic Screenwriter or Microsoft Word or whatever they were using. You guys could develop something. So we did.
And I see that the way the Montage works is not only does it actually format your script so it looks the way that people want to read it in the industry, but it's actually a complete development tool that allows you to keep track of, all your characters and your locations and any research you've got that goes into the script. It all gets stored in the same file. So effectively it's a complete work document for a script you're working on. Is that correct?
Yes, absolutely. It encompasses the three, parts, pre-writing, the writing, and then actually the post-writing process, which is submitting, writing a query letter, writing a synopsis of the script, and actually sending it, off to different various studios and agents.
And we were talking before we started recording about, I was asking you, do you feel that the OS environment that Macintosh, provides is to creative types, it sort of does promote this sort of, much more software that actually supports the creative process rather than, on the Windows side, it's just basically it's office software and you just have to try and mold it into what you want it to do.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think Apple's strategy for many years has been squarely, you know, focused on the creative markets. I mean, it's evidenced by the fact that you turn on the TV or watch any Hollywood movie and you see Macs. I mean, much more than you would see the actual ratio that's probably out in the world. Macs are a lot sexier to use, and they're, you know, they really do well in those creative spaces. And that's, you know, firmly where we're comfortable is in, you know, creative spaces. You know, take for instance our new product, StoryMill, which is for novel writing. I mean, there's probably, you know, hundreds if not thousands of word processors out there. You know, there's no app like StoryMill for having a structured based approach to writing a novel.
Yeah.
I like in the screenshot you have one that says keep things organized. That's kind of a metaphor for life there, I think.
I mean, that's the thing. I mean, there's nothing that frustrates me more than when I'm reading a novel and you find that you can sometimes see areas where it's either been edited or where the author has got a bit confused. You know, you'll find characters, the names might be spelt differently, or you know, they might repeat things that they've said previously, and you're thinking, oh, the writer obviously got a little bit bogged down here.
They have a really bad editor, yes.
Yeah, but, you know, and I would imagine there's plenty of aspiring writers who basically keep track of all of that stuff on bits of paper and notes or just in their head rather than actually having it to hand on the computer as they're bringing the document together.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, StoryMill does several things towards that end. We have smart views. So just like smart playlists in iTunes or smart folders in the Finder, we have a way to filter, you know, the content. So you could actually check your, you know, like your characters, the continuity throughout the script. And that's something that holds true for montage as well as StoryMill. Then another thing in StoryMill that you can do is you can actually visualize your storylines in a timeline view. So you can actually see in a more like an iCal kind of look, where you can see your scenes laid out in time. So if you're mixing different time periods, or if you're actually trying to craft, you know, how this story actually took place in time, it's a wonderful tool to visualize that. And it's something that the other products don't have. And it ends up making the writer a lot more organized, but mostly more cognizant of, you know, hey, all this needs to, the continuity here needs to be kept to make a more engaging, novel.
You know, one of the things that I've noticed a lot lately is a lot of writers that are on the web are talking about distraction-free writing applications that will fill the entire screen so you can concentrate on what you're doing. You guys have been ahead of that curve for a long time with Mac Journal, no?
Yes, definitely. I think that we had a full screen mode prior to I don't know, I didn't think it was actually a trend at that time. It was just something that we added. And then, you know, StoryMill has a full screen mode, and so does Montage. So it's something that we firmly believe in, because when we looked at different ways that people write, and we've surveyed our users, there's several different types of people, and there's definitely a type that is constantly procrastinating.
Yeah, that's me.
Yeah, I think a lot of us fall into that. And so if you see the iChat icon bouncing in your dock, or you see that you have new mail messages with that handy little badge, you tend to click off, and then you get away from writing. So it's a really handy tool to have for being distraction free and focusing on the writing. I know back before it was a trend, I used to joke and say it's actually the Doogie Howser MD mode.
Yeah.
So how long have you been with Mariner Software now?
Oh, several years now. And, I've been good friends with the founder for, more years than I can count.
Yeah. What made you decide to take a job with the company? I mean, obviously you were friends with the founder first, and then you joined the company later. What was the one thing that said, yeah, okay, let's do that?
The opportunity. Formerly I worked for Now Software, with yeah, that.
I liked Now.
Okay, I was the product manager for Now, UpToDate and Contact for many years. And
are they still around? Is Now still actually out there?
Yes. Yeah, they are retooling Now, UpToDate and Contact with a code name of Nighthawk. And they're working on something. Ooh. They've been working on it for several years, but it's not out yet. But we love those guys there. I'm still good friends with all the guys at Now Software. But I just, you know, it was a better opportunity for me, and I have more creative control. So we, you know,
it's always important.
We're and we have many more products. So instead of working on one product, I get to manage lots of different developers on lots of different, you know, products. So it keeps life interesting.
Corey, what was your first Mac? I'm always curious when I talk to people what the first Mac that they had was.
The first Mac. Well, I'll take you even back a little further than that. My first computer was a TRS-80 color computer with 4K.
Oh, yeah.
The old trash 80s.
Yeah, so beyond that.
I have one of those, by the way, still to this day. I have one.
eBay, my friend, eBay.
I got mine in the box. It was never used.
Wow.
Never. I don't know if that's a shame or if that's a good thing.
To this day, it has about an hour's worth of time on it.
So I went from there. I went to the Apple IIs and through the Apple II line to the 2GS and then up into the old 512K Mac and Mac Plus and Mac SE. And I've had more Macs than I can count. So
what was your favorite one of all of those machines that you've owned, excluding the current one? Because of course that's just too easy. It's faster, and it's, you know, and a lot of people think they're so sexy right now, sexier than they've ever been, which is kind of weird to say about a computer, but it's true. Which has been your favorite?
Boy, I would have to say I really got the most use when I got the PowerBook 520C. I took that all over the world.
Blackbird, right?
Yeah, the Blackbird. I took that to I was actually living at the time. I was living in South Korea and traveling to Japan and doing business.
On your Shipnica.
And, I took that everywhere. And it just, you know, it was just a workhorse of a computer. So I really enjoyed that that computer. And it also seemed to last longer than humanly possible.
I've got one of those machines as well. The battery long ago died, but if you plug it in, it still works.
Yeah. Yeah, I even upgraded mine with the newer technology, like with the PowerPC processor, and did that whole
kept it going as long as possible.
Yeah, right? Yeah, cuz it was like a good good old friend I didn't want to see die.
Yeah. So how many Macs do you have now?
Wow. Personally,
sure. Well, obviously, Mariner Software probably has them scattered all over.
Yeah, we have them scattered.
Probably all holding them. The windows open.
Yeah,
those
well,
there's some, yeah, good for that.
Yeah, and Bondi Blue IMAX now are. I would say here at my house, six.
Wow, how many are actually in use?
Five.
Five of those.
Oh,
wow,
that is good.
Yeah,
that's a lot of machines.
It is. I have a son that uses one. I have a daughter that uses another, and you know, then there's one in the kitchen when I'm cooking, and there's.
You sound as bad as I do, Corey. I tell you.
Yeah,
it's a different world that we live in now, that we have so many of these, and they're so common that we just have computers in all these different rooms, and we just kind of take it for granted. Are they all running Leopard? Do they all share the same bookmarks? Or obviously the kids probably want their own bookmarks.
Yeah, the kids have their own. A couple of them are older. There's a G4 Tower and a couple iMacs, and there's an older iBook. So everything, most of them are on Tiger. And then, you know, my machines primarily are on Leopard. But, you know, I look at more like computers almost more as appliances now. So
yeah,
like I just need to get information out of it, or I need something. It's a tool to do something. So whereas before it was, you know, it's like I'm using a computer. It was something special. It's now just let me get to the content. You know, it's as familiar as a toaster. You don't think about the toaster. You think that you want toast.
And so Mariner Software doesn't just produce Mac software. You guys got a couple of these same programs on the Windows side, correct?
We do. It's kind of like our customers, again, urged us, you know, oh, if you just have that product for Windows, you'd take the world by storm. So it's kind of a necessary evil, so to speak. But, you know, it's always a challenging development environment to go to Windows and try to get, you know, try to do more like user-centric design with the tools that they have. It's a lot harder on the Windows platform. But, yeah, we have Desktop Poet for Windows, and we also have WinJournal, which is kind of akin to MacJournal for the Windows platform.
Yeah, that one that does podcasting too, and so does the Mac version?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Now, see, as a podcaster, and to be honest, I've never looked at that product. I use GarageBand to record myself. I obviously use Skype to talk. I'm talking to you via Skype right now, and I'm recording that Skype conversation in Audio Hijack Pro. What would Mac Journal do for me as a podcaster that I would be more interested in giving up maybe the GarageBand or some other solutions?
You know, Tim, I probably wouldn't push Mac Journal to you, being that you're a professional podcaster. But, you know,
I feel so important now.
The abilities in Mac Journal basically is you can record audio, and you can, you know, do a lot of the settings for what kind of audio you want to record. However, as far as, you know, really like remixing it and cutting out parts and that kind of thing, it's not really meant for that.
It's more of a recorder.
Yeah.
Which is important. That's software that I have relatives who GarageBand is just way too complicated for them. There's just, I try to tell them it's not that difficult, but they're just like, ooh, I don't want to use that. I just want to be able to record my voice. So this would be a good solution for them.
Oh, absolutely. They click one button and then they talk. And then they click another button and it's posted up onto their blog. And then
that's excellent.
So it's GarageBand. I don't know. Someone tried to convince me at one time, that GarageBand was like a consumer level app. And I don't really agree. It's very specialized and
prosumer, I would say. It's not quite a pro application, but it's not quite a consumer application either.
Right. But it's not something like I would take my, my son and sit him down and say, here's GarageBand, go ahead. You know,
there's definitely a learning curve with it. I've found that, you know, once you get your head around the concept of it, then you can make it hum along, but it's not something that somebody who's never done any sort of audio recording before can just pick up and go with.
Definitely. And it was a natural, you know, podcasting was a natural fit for Mac Journal and WinJournal. Because, you know, the apps are squarely focused on journaling, and one of the things about journaling is just all the different mixed media that you can throw in there. You know, people browse websites and drop, you know, different web clippings in there, and audio files and video, and, you know, kind of compiling it all together and then having the ability to, you know, with a single click of a button, publish that. Is quite powerful, but it's also, you know, the real power in it is, producing that content for other people to read, like family or friends.
Yeah.
So, Corey, is there something about Mariner Software that our listeners might not know that they would be very interested in knowing?
Oh boy.
Well, we have group hot tub meetings. Nothing like that.
Well, we have a physical office in downtown Minneapolis, Minnesota, and it's in the Designers Guild building, which is really cool, a really cool space. But however, we have employees scattered across the United States and abroad. So
working remotely.
Yeah, so we work remotely, but it's really cool because when we go to events like Macworld, and, you know, we also go out to like Screenwriters Expo, and last year I got to go to Cannes Film Festival, and
that would be cool.
You know,
you get to hang out with the really cool crowd actually with this kind of software.
I guess so. I actually did get to walk the red carpet last year at a premiere. It was pretty cool. But
and we get Owen Rubin.
It's neat that when we all get together at these types of events. So it's like, oh, hey, we have the, you know, company summit meeting and we all get to see each other in person after, you know, we work with each other on a daily basis, you know, all year long, but then you don't see the person, you know, physically.
Yeah, that would be cool. We kind of have that situation with MyMac.com in that nobody lives next to each other, so about the only time we all get together, at least the majority of us, would be Macworld Expo. In fact, David Cohen, I met him for the first year at this Macworld Expo in San Francisco because he lives in the UK, so the chances of us, you know, getting together is pretty remote.
So we're both still having therapy as a result of that.
Absolutely, yeah. Especially my wife. So do you know of any popular or award-winning works that were created on your software?
Or can you
not talk about it?
Yeah, there's actually a lot of them that we can't talk about, but there's probably a couple people I could plug. On the montage front, there's a leading comic book writer. His name is Cody Chamberlain. Mm-hmm. He's a huge fan of montage, and because of him, we're really doing a lot more comic book stuff in montage. And And then we have several writers in Storymill that have written their novels that are getting published. There's more details on our website about some of their profiles, rather than me going into each and every one of their stories. But there's on the montage side, there are a lot of writers that are using it that I cannot talk about. But there's major movies that you've seen that were the movie was written in montage.
That's kind of cool. The company is Mariner Software. You could check them out at marinersoftware.com or go up to the MyMac website, look for show 174. I'll have a link directly to the Mariner Software website. Corey, we want to thank you much for coming on the show this week, talking about Mariner Software, your history on the Mac, and hopefully we'll have you guys back when you guys get a new big product coming out, and we want to share that information with our listeners. Thanks a lot.
Absolutely, Tim. I'll leave you with a little teaser. It might actually be sooner rather than later. We have a couple things waiting in the wings, and we'll have some big announcements coming up, and you know, we're all had our eyes on the iPhone SDK. So
yeah, I wasn't going to bring that up because I didn't know if you guys had any plans or if you guys are looking at making something for it. But I mean, that's a pretty attractive platform, and Mariner Software with 17 years of programming, I would think that would be a natural fit.
It is. It is. you know, without letting any proverbial cats out of the bag, it would be great to have a blogging solution. It would be great to be able to take your Hollywood script around with you. It would be great to be able to open an Excel spreadsheet and edit it and send it back out from your iPhone.
That's a heck of a tease. Thank you very much, Corey.
All right. Thanks, guys.
We have a special edition of Book Bites Live. I'm holding in my hand Adobe InDesign CS3 one-on-one. The author is Deke McClellan. The publisher is O'Reilly Media and Deke Press, that's D-E-K-E, and the price in the U.S. is $54.99, and in Canada, it's $54.99. What do you know about that? We are delighted to have Deke McClellan back on the MyMac.com Book Bites Live podcast, and I understand, Deke, you just came off the Geek Cruise. Can you tell us, like in 99 words or less, what it's like to be a member of the Geek Cruise faculty?
Yeah, actually, it's really great. It's a swell time. We went to the Eastern Caribbean this time around. This was the fifth Photoshop Fling cruise that we've done. It's just a really relaxing, nice time. I know most of the folks because they come again and again. It was great. And actually, this time, my wife Elizabeth and I brought our kids, Max and Sam, along with us. So first time we've done that since the very, very first cruise that we did, which was a Mac Mania cruise.
Well, I'm sure it'll be a cruise to remember for your kids.
Yeah, it's awesome. The first time we did it, Sammy was 3 weeks old, so it was something of a disaster. And this time he's five, so.
Well, I've been watching your kids grow up through all the books that I've been reading over the years.
And I'm showing them off a lot. They're convenient models.
Let's talk about Adobe InDesign CS3 One-on-One by Deke McClellan. Uh-huh. What's on the DVD? And you can give short answers because we want people to be motivated to learn about this book themselves. What's on the DVD?
Yeah, I don't do short answers, John. I don't know what you're talking about.
How different or similar is the DVD from your lynda.com content?
Well, it's totally different. It's completely unique to the book. And actually, right now, it's funny you mention this, because right this moment, I don't have any InDesign content for lynda.com. I've got Illustrator and Photoshop like crazy, like more than 100 hours of Photoshop stuff. InDesign, I haven't contributed to the library yet. And the reason I say it's funny you ask is because tomorrow I take off for Miami to do the Pixel conference. And then when I get done with that, I'm going to go to lynda.com and do some InDesign content. So, but the short answer you're looking for, John, is it's totally unique content to the book. And that's true for all the books. It's always unique book content, and that doesn't appear anywhere else.
Now, another thing that's unique to your book are these quizzes at the end of every chapter. How important are those quizzes? Do the readers need to get a perfect score on each one?
No, not necessarily. I mean, the idea behind the quizzes is just an opportunity for you to test your knowledge. I would say, actually, of all the components in the book, probably the quizzes are the least important, which is not to say they're unimportant. It's just that they're just a method for you to test your knowledge, and they're usually vocabulary words that you're testing. The real, I think, core strength of the book is that we're building knowledge in over the course of performing these step-by-step tutorials. And the tutorials are designed to walk you through a real-world project. So you're trying to create something that you might actually create in a larger world. And there's context, and I'm telling you why we're performing each step. And you're coming up with a project in the end that you should be proud of. So now we're not just sort of screwing off and just trying out a few tools. We're really trying to get something done.
But do readers need to plow through this entire book, Adobe InDesign CS3 one-on-one? Do they need to plow through the whole thing, or is it okay if they sort of jump around on an as-needed basis?
They can jump around if they want to. The book is certainly designed to build on the strengths that we've learned about in previous lessons. If you already know that stuff and you want to skip forward, you certainly can. But it's meant to serve as a learning system. So if you're either new to InDesign or your experience with other programs, but Page Layout is new to you, or something along those lines, and this book is designed to take you from beginning to end and turn you into a page layout machine, essentially. And I'm using a lot of different things. You mentioned the DVD that's included with the book. Basically, there's 12 lessons inside the book, and the way that the learning system is designed is that you start by reading an introduction to the lesson, so you have a sense of what we're going to be doing, and then you go off to the video. There's a 15 to 20 minute video included along with each lesson. There's 3 hours of video altogether included with the book, and you watch the video, and that's where I show you what we're going to be doing inside the lesson, and that's not designed to be hands-on. I'm just showing you what you're in for, and it's just some of the things are easier to show you than to tell you. And then we go into the step-by-steps, and there's anywhere from 3 to 7 step-by-step exercises in each one of the lessons, and then you wind down with the quiz. And I think probably the strongest thing specifically about this book, the Adobe InDesign CS3 book, is that it's really a sample document in and of itself, because it was completely created inside of InDesign. So you get a sense of what a real world project feels like in your hands, and you're looking at it as you're working through it. And the book is really, we've really upped the quality of the book. I don't know how much you've sort of gone through it.
Oh, I read every page frontwards, backwards, upside down, and right side up.
All right, so now that we changed it out a lot from, and I say we because it's kind of a team effort, and between CS2 and CS3, we probably changed out 50% of the content just because I really wanted to up the quality of the book in general. So we got some what I consider to be better project files in there, and there's also some really fun layout stuff going on and design stuff going on inside the book, where we really push the boundaries in terms of basically bringing the sample projects into the book. Because one of the challenges of doing a book in InDesign about InDesign is that I'm trying to show you the sample projects on the page, but the sample projects are pages. So the question becomes, do I shrink these pages down to these tiny little screenshots so you can't really see what's going on, or do we take advantage of you know, do we try a more creative approach? And by a more creative approach, I mean we sometimes basically synthesize the sample documents into the pages that you're reading so that one is fading into the other. So there's a lot of, I think, interesting stuff going on there. And it enables us to show you the documents a lot larger so you can see what's going on.
How important is it for readers to work with your famous Deke keys and your keyboard shortcuts and the formatting shortcuts on page 104 and 105? How important is it for people to learn all those various shortcuts and Deke-isms as opposed to just doing it their own boring, dumb way like they would do without this book?
Well, I'm not sure they're doing it a boring, dumb way before, but the advantage of the D keys, and there's also a best workflow document in there that's designed to create a seamless color-managed workflow across the various Adobe applications. And the reasons I provide these documents are twofold. One is the best workflow document allows you and I to get the same results, so that what you're seeing on your screen more or less matches what you're going to see on a printed page. Not 100%, because we're talking about RGB versus CMYK, but we'll get a close match. And when I tell you there's something orange on the page, you're going to see it as orange, not as red or drifting off into amber or something like that. And then where the D keys are concerned, that's something I provide with basically all of my training for Photoshop or Illustrator or InDesign and so on. And the idea there is that there's certain commands inside the software and certain operations that should have keyboard shortcuts. They just really are screaming out for keyboard shortcuts, and they don't have them by default. And so one of the best examples, like sort of the perfect example in terms of InDesign insofar as I'm concerned, is that when you get done working on some text, you're sitting there typing in a little bit of text and you're done with it, and you basically want to deactivate the text, switch back to the black arrow tool, and be able to do some object sort of work on the page. In CS2, you didn't have any way to pull that off automatically. And then in CS3, they decided they needed something there, and so they decided to make it the escape key, which I think is absolutely wrong-headed, because the escape key in all the other Adobe applications, if you're typing, especially in Photoshop, if you're typing some text and you hit escape, you abandon the text, which makes sense. I mean, that's what escape is about abandoning the operation. In InDesign, I think without a lot of reasoning going on there, it goes ahead and implements the changes you've made. So what I did instead is I made it the enter key on the keypad, on the numerical keypad. So if you hit the enter key, instead of adding a column break, which is something you don't do very often, you'll go ahead and deactivate the text, and you'll fix that text down and be able to work on something else. And there's a lot of other stuff that's like that. There's basically the line balance and creating a non-breaking character, or actually, no, I'm sorry, selecting some text and setting it to not break across lines is another keyboard shortcut I add. And there's a handful of them. There's actually quite a few in the InDesign D keys.
Okay.
And so I it's not essential to answer your question, but it's a good idea.
Good. I got a couple of short questions for you. It looks like you needed about 5 years to make this book and the DVD because it's so comprehensive. I mean, yeah. A, would you consider this to be suitable for a college course? And B, yes. How long did it really take you to make the book and the CD?
About 5 years. the yes is the answer to the first question. Yeah, it's definitely designed to be a course book. It's designed for teachers, it's designed for students, and it's designed for self-paced learners. So, but it's definitely designed for folks who are trying to learn the software either in a classroom or outside of a classroom environment. In terms of how long it took an extraordinary amount of time. If you take a look at one of the early pages in the book shows you, lists all the people who contributed to the title.
Yeah.
And it's a pretty huge team. It's about 20 people and all that work on this darn thing. And it's a pretty group. But I mean, I was just trying to bite off so much this time. And because I decided that we needed to just do total reapproaches to about half the book, in order to, like I was saying, up the quality level, that meant that we were spending a ton of time. And I had an editor, Colleen Wheeler, who was working on a lot of the pieces. I had my designer, David Futato, who's the designer for the book in general, who contributed some sample documents. And there were a lot of people. We had a new tech editor, Ron, who did a totally terrific job. So it took us we were kind of late to market with this book, and it was partially because we were spending so many months on the title in addition to what we thought we would do.
Okay. So. Now, last night when I was working on the pencil and the pen tool using the video, you did your video using the mouse as opposed to a graphic tablet. Do people really, is it much better for them? And again, a short answer is fine. To just invest in a graphic tablet and start to use that, and will that make them much more proficient as far as their detail work?
I bounce back and forth a lot between a tablet and a mouse. I'll use it. Basically, I don't have a tablet sitting out all the time because it takes up desk space, and also I find that I have more wrist problems if I use a stylus on a regular basis.
Oh yeah. Uh-huh.
So I use a mouse for most of my work, but I use a tablet very often. I have several sitting around here. But no, I don't think honestly, there's nothing you can't do, especially where a product like InDesign is concerned. There's nothing you can't do with a mouse. It's going to be if you're doing a lot of painterly work inside of Photoshop or if you're trying to draw smooth lines with basically the freehand drawing tool inside of Illustrator, you might find that the pen tool helps you out, or you might not. Some people really, really love them and just absolutely take to them, and other folks, you know, it just doesn't quite work for them. So it depends. I mean, if you're fed up with a mouse, then pen is a great way to go. And Wacom's the king of those things, and they do some really great tablets.
Good. And our last question is, why does InDesign think your name is Duke, not Deke?
The spell checker?
Yes.
Yeah, the spell checker. Yeah, it does a lot of things, a lot of nasty things with my name, actually. The joke in the book is that I think I've been called every single one of the names that the spell checker suggests over the course of my life, and most of them in junior high school. But but it doesn't know either my first or last name. But, you know, it doesn't the spell checker doesn't know, like, it doesn't recognize CS. It doesn't recognize CS3. You know, it doesn't recognize. It used to not recognize the name of most of, you know, Adobe's own applications. So, it doesn't recognize Microsoft. It'll spell check you on that, which I think is petty.
Yeah.
But you know, there's a lot of stuff. There's a lot of stuff lacking from that spell checker. Actually,
well, we're delighted to talk to Deke McClellan. We'll certainly keep our eye on you. We congratulate you on this excellent book. We recommend this book very highly to the readers and the listeners of MyMac.com. Once again, it's Adobe InDesign CS3 One-on-One. The author is Deke McClellan. The publisher is O'Reilly Media and Deke Press. And we hope you sell 100 million copies, Deke, because we'll be looking for your next book, and we'll be looking to meet you again at Macworld in person in San Francisco and to keep in touch with you here on the MyMac.com podcast. Thanks again.
And I want to thank Sam Levin for taking the time to talk to me. Obviously, we hope that he makes it home okay. Driving and talking on the cell phone at the same time, talking about a really cool event that happened today. Obviously, the Apple SDK iPhone release, the roadmap, what's coming up. And we're going to talk a little bit about that right now with David Cohen from the UK. Hello, David.
Hi there, Tim. How are you?
I'm doing well. We also got both of these guys are on the East Coast. Guy Searle. Hi, Guy.
Hey, East Coast rules, buddy.
And Lee Givens. Hi, Lee.
Hey, how's everything going? How's everyone doing?
I'm doing great, and I'm really happy with AOL at the moment, Lee, the company that you work for, when you're
excellent.
Not wasting your time here on our lowly podcast, because I watched this event in the QuickTime streaming that Apple has up on their website right now. And the application that I was the most excited about was chatting, AIM, on the iPhone. It's awesome.
Yeah, you wouldn't imagine how many requests we get every day about, you know, we need to get a new, I do hear everybody talking about we really need to get a new AIM client for the Mac. We're working on that. But getting AIM on the iPhone, getting a really good chat client is something a lot of people ask for. And we're just happy that Steve brought us up on stage to talk about AIM today.
So how long ago did you know about this?
Let's see. What time did the Engadget thing start? 1 p.m. You got to love Apple. They're really good at keeping the lid on things. So
sure. So you didn't know about the AIM ahead of time?
We had inklings, but we had a lot of, you know, fingers crossed and hopes. But you never know who Steve's going to feature on the on stage.
Does it kind of surprise you and AOL in general that Apple is going to allow a chatting program that's not iChat? Obviously, iChat uses your services, the AIM network, to work. but to actually allow America Online to create AIM for the iPhone. That's going to be, I think, probably the default solution for chatting on the iPhone. Is that a surprise to you guys?
Oh, yeah. It's not a big surprise, because if you took a look at our news a couple days ago, we opened up the new OpenAIM platform. And in the early days, Apple was, I think, I have to get my history straight, but I think Apple was the first company to be on the AIM network that didn't do it through some circumvented means.
Yeah.
So it was the first partner, and I'm just glad that Apple looked to us to help build this IM client for the iPhone.
I'm really looking forward to it. That's the application that I absolutely want. Is that going to launch with the iPhone 2.0 beta? Or, the actual release in the end of June?
Yeah, we're hoping. We're going to work really close with Apple and make sure that we get the, new version of the SDK, make sure we get the code for the new AIM client to be as flawless as we can, and get that out there. And hopefully it ships right about the same time the new 2.0 firmware ships.
David, you're an iPhone user.
Yeah, I am.
Besides AIM, is there anything that you're really looking forward to that maybe you saw today, or something that's not out yet that you're hoping someone develops?
Well, I'm very interested to see how the Exchange integration works, because at the moment I have to carry an iPhone and a BlackBerry, and the BlackBerry is hooked into our Exchange server in the office. And in fact, I had a query via our IT department from another iPhone user, for somebody who's just joined the company about 2-3 weeks ago, saying, oh, he wants to know how he can get his Exchange email on the iPhone. And I said, well, not yet, but there's an SDK coming, so hopefully somebody will do it. But obviously I'm really pleased to hear that Apple has partnered with Microsoft to do that, because that means it should be a rock-solid solution. And I think it's a real, real puts a stake in the ground. I mean, Apple clearly don't want the iPhone to be just a consumer device. They are going after, the big boys in the smartphone market, and obviously, the big one would be RIM with the BlackBerry. So I think it's a very, very positive move on their part to say that they really want to see the iPhone as a corporate device and not just as a consumer device. And hopefully, it will help them get to that 10 million target by the end of the year.
Now, Guy, you don't own an iPhone. Will the announcements made today, the opening up of this platform, the delivery mechanism, which we'll get to in a minute, is all this kind of making you want an iPhone now, or pushing you towards actually buying one?
It's certainly making me much more interested in the platform.
Or even the touch. I mean, the touch is going to have all the same capabilities except, obviously, the telephone.
Well, if I was going to get a device like this, I would go ahead and go for the iPhone.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think Apple licensing Microsoft's Exchange services is really that big of a surprise. Microsoft likes to sell software, and Apple likes to sell hardware. So, and if you want to actually get into the enterprise market, well, instead of trying to make people use some solution that they're not used to, go ahead and use what everyone else is using.
And that's going to be Exchange, obviously.
That's right.
And now, during your day job, you work with a lot of different government agencies, Guy. Do you see a lot of iPhone users? You might. Do you see a lot of iPhone users?
No. No, I don't.
Do you think this might change that?
Kind of hard to say, because, there's business and then there's government. And if you think business is hard to get people to change their minds, try dealing with government people who've been doing the same thing since, like, 1920.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, one of the things that surprised me was the ease of use as far as getting the software onto your iPhone. You're not going to have to use iTunes to buy or get some of the free software for the iPhone itself. It's going to be built right into each and every phone as soon as the iPhone 2.0 software comes out. Lee, do you think that's going to be big for Apple and the users?
Yeah, I think, if you read I think Macworld had an article today saying that, I can't remember who wrote it, but he said Apple, this is the first announcement he's ever had where Apple did every single thing right. He said all the features, the distribution mechanisms, the way of doing payments back to the software investors, and even partnering with Kleiner Perkins to do the iFund.
$100 million.
$100 million.
I'm seriously thinking about becoming an iPhone developer.
I know. I was going to get my Cocoa developer book out and start writing code again.
I tell ya.
But I think this is probably I think a lot of people are going to mark, you know, today is one of the seminal events in Apple history. This is going to make iPhone, I think it has a potential being a bigger platform than the Mac and iPod.
You really think so?
I think this is going to, people are going to look back and say, wow, this is,
that was
this,
the day.
This is just like January 26, 1984. This is going to be just like, October 2001 when the iPod came out. All those dates are going to, this is going to be one of those days, I think.
I think
does anyone have any question that Apple is not going to be able to sell 10 million iPhones by the end of 2008? Or does anyone have any doubt?
Oh, I think that this cemented it myself.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think this is like getting that first round draft pick and you're ready to go. I think they made it pretty clear that they are going to try to. I have a feeling that, you know, I saw some reports today that they're going to be 30% ahead of projections. I think it could even be double.
Yeah. I'm really looking forward to the games myself. David, iPhone user, is game something that you're kind of interested in having on there? Because we've talked about this in the past with no tactile sensation and that sort of thing. But from the demonstrations today.
Super Monkey Ball.
Super Monkey Ball. And the funny thing is, I was just talking about Super Monkey Ball. And was it last week?
Yeah, it was last week.
That's right, yeah. That's right. You were definitely keyed in on that one.
I think,
actually, I mean, this is the start of a whole new platform. I mean, I think iPhone and iPod Touch are really just the beginning. Obviously, the SDK is capable of much more than supporting just these two devices. It is a complete development platform. There's all sorts of stuff in there. They're setting, you know, a cementing of the iPhone strategy with this announcement today. And I suspect, you know, the fact that it is so broad, you know, they've covered the enterprise, they've covered business applications, they've covered games, they've covered the with AOL they're looking at communications applications. It wouldn't surprise me if come Macworld next year we actually see new devices that aren't really iPhone or iTouch, iPod Touch like, but they're actually something else again. That might be gaming. It might be a tablet. You know, the fabled Newton replacement that people are still harking out for. You know, really, there's no reason why this SDK couldn't be used to build applications that are going to scale to different, larger, and more capable devices in the future. So, I think that's really what made me sit up and take notice when they started talking about the game support, and they've got EA there working with them, because really that does say to me they are looking beyond just the little iPhone screen, the little iPod touch screen, to maybe something that might be quite different in the future.
Two of the five applications that they demoed today were games.
Yeah.
Does that surprise you?
No, because I think, I mean, Apple's strategy has always been, let's develop software and that'll sell hardware units. And I think, gaming is obviously a very, very large market, very lucrative market. At the same time, I don't think they want to put themselves in the position that, that companies like Sony have gotten themselves into, where actually, they've just lost a fortune on the hardware and are struggling to compete in the market with the other hardware developers. So, I think this is a clever approach. They really are, they've put a fantastic set of tools that can allow all sorts of different applications to be developed, and really should stimulate the platform. And I think, I've been fairly close to the unofficial development community for the iPhone, because I'm over here in the UK for a long time. I had to run third party software on my iPhone to make it work in the UK because it hadn't launched here yet. So I think they've taken some lessons from that, and I think this new approach to distributing the applications, I think they've looked at what the hacker community have done, and they've said that's a good model. We can do that officially.
Hey Dave, can I ask you a question?
Sure.
Do you think that considering the possible huge success of this platform, that Apple could open it up for other people to make devices, not necessarily for them, but for like a license fee?
I don't see
iPhone,
that happening myself.
Not so much iPhone clones?
I think they might. Well, it'd be interesting to see whether they went that way, but I suspect that you know, they like to retain the control. I think they have been burnt in the past with third party licensing. You know, when they had, you know, the Mac clones, and you know, they found that people were undercutting them. To me, it always goes back to the fact that they're using the software to stimulate the hardware sales, because that's where they make their money.
And they've done that for years now, and they got really good at it with the iTunes and the iPod.
That's true.
Exactly. So,
okay,
so you know,
we got one more question, but this one's for Lee. Lee, you're the of the four of us, you're more of a software developer. Were you surprised that they weren't going to update the iPhone or add new apps to the iPhone through iTunes, and Bren was going to develop a separate app for it?
Yeah, I was a little surprised, but I think that Apple, if you look at the whole program, Apple spent a lot of time talking to enterprise customers. They spent a lot of time talking to their partners at Nike and Genentech and all the places they talked about. They really wanted to make sure that this was a platform that enterprises who didn't want to distribute apps through iTunes or any other mechanism like that had the means to develop apps and just deploy them on their local networks without ever having to talk to Apple. And then, you know, giving everyone the tools. I mean, the thing that really shocked me today is just trying to get on the iPhone SDK website was busy.
Yeah, it was impossible.
For hours.
Yep.
So that just shows me, I think there's a lot of pent-up demand, and everyone's, you know, every software developer looks to see, you know, when there's a new platform, it's really something, you know, I could be one of the first people out there to build something that's really, really cool, and having multi-touch and having a really high DPI screen. And I was surprised at, you know, seeing the Spore demo, how fast the games could play on the processor that's inside the iPhone.
Didn't the Spore demo make you want to jump on iTunes and download that game right now? It did me. I so wanted that game.
It's a game I think my kids would even enjoy playing.
Absolutely. Now, here's one of the technologies in the enterprise segment that if the phone gets lost, they can literally, the Exchange server can send a command out to the iPhone, and it wipes the iPhone. There's no user interaction at all. So if you're in possession of a stolen iPhone, boom, it gets wiped. You think that's kind of a solution, Lee, that could come to the consumer market as well, that if your iPhone gets stolen or lost, you can simply call Apple and boom, they can wipe that phone?
Yeah, that's one of the things I was thinking about. I could see a lot of people, you know, have storing all their information on there. I mean, I have all my contacts on there.
My
photo.
Hate that. Yeah, if that thing got lost, ugh.
I think Apple's going to find out, because they're so strong in the consumer space and enterprise is something new for them on the iPhone. I think they're going to find out that they're going to have services that, you know, some of these enterprise services people want. And being able to kill your phone, or even being able to use some of the location services inside the phone to track where your phone is.
Yeah,
that would be kind of interesting too.
I think it'd be interesting also to bring some of that push calendaring software to the consumer market, so that I can add something in iCal and I don't necessarily have to plug the phone into that computer to have it synced, to have it on there. I mean, if my wife has an iPhone, she doesn't, but eventually she will. And I want to add something, I can simply add it right there and it gets pushed out there. Or do you think that's something that maybe a third party solution could step in and take over?
Yeah, I can't remember who I talked to. I found somebody on the floor at Macworld who's building a whole bunch of applications that do nothing but syncing from all different types of calendars, online services. I think this is a pretty big thing. I mean, right now I do a pretty elaborate calendar syncing between my iPhone and my wife's iPhone and my office entourage with – I mean, it's a pretty elaborate system. And once I upgraded to Leopard, I kind of broke something. So it took me, I'm not joking, it took me a week to get everything back to normal.
Is elaborate a euphemism for a pain in the ass?
Well, if you can see, you can see where I stored the data and all the different sync services I used to. So my stuff goes from my corporate office to get synced to another location, then I get it in iCal, then iCal publishes out to .Mac, and then I get it on my iPhone. So I'm just glad that I'll be able to take shortcuts. I mean, I looked at the new ActiveSync agreement that they did with Microsoft. There's no more, you know, middlemen sitting between the computer, I mean, the iPhone and the Exchange server. It looks like it's going to be a pretty nice, elegant solution. And I think, you know, I just can't wait till my corporate guys get a copy of that new software.
You know, one of the things that when you click the mail icon, I noticed it brings you to a different screen. One of them was Exchange, obviously, but I saw American Online on there as well. Is that something that you were aware of, or?
Yeah, we're happy when Apple first announced the iPhone. They picked, you know, of course, .Mac, They had Gmail, they had Yahoo, and they and right there you could press on the fourth, you could press on the AOL icon and configure your AOL mail really quickly.
Yeah, it looks cool.
So, you know, a lot of people still, you know, AOL, you know, there's a lot of things we haven't done well in the past, but I think you're going to start to see a lot of things we want to do better. And we're still, you know, we're the only set, third party that you could log into iTunes and use it for purchasing songs on in iTunes. So yeah. We're just hoping to, you know, take it step by step and keep building. Our main goal for the next, you know, forever is to build good software on the Mac and build build really good software on iPhone. And it's going to take a long time for us to get the trust of all the people that we've, you know, worked with in the past. But it's going to be a long road, but I'm really looking forward to it.
AOL client on the iPhone.
I'm working on I really want to get my, you know, I got the SDK downloaded. I want to start coding.
Yeah, I don't blame you a bit. So, Guy.
Yes.
What else is going on in the Mac world right now? Obviously, I think we probably beat. Big noise you heard, that was me knocking everything over. So what else is going on in the Mac world right now, Guy?
Apple fell very, very short of their 1,000 movie mark for the Apple TV. And, of course, they're blaming the movie studios, which is probably 90% true. Steve Jobs is also now only the 189th richest person in the world. He fell 57 places.
I know, it's sad.
I hope he can still keep a roof over his head.
Well, I don't think he's going to be missing any meals.
No, I think that guy's probably set for a long time. I don't think it's going to be any skin off of him at all.
And, of course, we also had the new MacBooks and MacBook Pros last week, which led to me finally getting a new MacBook Pro. Not new MacBook Pro, but a refurb MacBook Pro.
Why did you go with the refurb rather than a new one? Just price?
Yeah, price. You know, I ended up getting the 233, I think, from two generations ago. They had a 2.2 that was $50 less, but it had, like, only half of the same VRAM that the 233 did. And I used the iBook G4 all the way through to Macworld this year. Now, that was almost 5 years on an iBook G4. So I hold on to my machines for a long time.
So has it arrived yet? You do have it?
Yes. I finally got it Tuesday night.
So what's your initial impressions?
It's unbelievable. Un-effing believable. I am delighted. Now, I didn't really get to use it much the first night because, you know, it was very, very odd. It came with 10.4, but it gave me Leopard disks. So before I could put all my info from the iBook over onto it, I had to, you know, first wipe it clean and then install Leopard, then install all my stuff from the iBook, then get all the updates. And by the time I finally got done with everything, it was like 11 o'clock at night, time to go to bed.
So now that you've got it up and running, you're happy.
I am a happy boy.
I think it's interesting, actually. I mean, I commented directly to you about this guy at the time, but I agree very much that the refurb machines are probably better value than these new computers, and certainly the benchmarks we've seen this week would sort of back that up. In terms of speed increases, there's not really an awful lot there. It's a few percentage points. There's a little bit extra battery life because these new Penryn processors, are a bit more power efficient than the older ones. But really, I mean, I've just been playing with a first generation MacBook Pro this last week that came to me from my brother. Now he's got his Air, and I've got the previous generation MacBook that's my main machine as well. So I can really see the difference between the first gen and the latest gen. And while there is a noticeable speed improvement on the new machine, it's not so much noticeable that you would say, "Oh, this old machine." By any stretch of the imagination. So I think, you know, these really are going to be incremental increases rather than radical increases as we move forward.
Yeah, and you know what? For $1,000 off, I'll take that. I'll take that little hit.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a significant amount of money.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
I was just going to ask Lee, do you steer people towards refurb machines if money's an issue, or do you try to always push them towards something newer?
Yeah, it's always about the person. So I have some friends who, you know, may have a little sister or something who's going to grad school, and I'm like, you know, definitely get a refurb. I mean, you want to save your money. But if I always tell people that if you're looking to keep a computer for a long time, and I'm in the same boat, as Guy. I purchased the first generation MacBook. I was at Macworld ordering it. Yeah. And I usually hold on to these machines for a long, long time. I said, if you want to hold on to it for a while, it's a good investment. But it depends on what you're looking at. I recommend when people buy like Apple Cinema displays, you get them from Apple. The refurbs are perfectly great. I've purchased myself, for my wife, iBook G4, and got a really good deal on it. It all depends on what you're looking for and how long you're going to keep it.
Most people don't realize that the process a refurbished machine from Apple goes through is actually a lot tighter. A lot more detail is going into those machines as a brand new one, because Apple really goes through those refurbs. If it's a certified Apple used machine, and usually they came back because maybe a power cord was bad or a motherboard and whatever the problem was, when the reason that it came back was completely replaced, and Apple really goes through those machines. So, Guy, I think you're probably going to have no problems with that machine at all.
I'm not anticipating any problems at all. I've been buying refurb machines, I guess going back to 2001 when I got the 933 G4 Tower. Mm-hmm. And I've had excellent luck with every single one of them.
Yeah,
it did come with a warranty as well. I mean, you get the same warranty
sure.
as if you bought
it's the
machine.
Same warranty as if it was a new machine.
Yep,
and you can get AppleCare with them as well.
And the AppleCare, yeah. So really, all you're getting is a slightly slower machine, and quite honestly,
significant savings.
Yeah, but nowadays, now obviously, this probably wouldn't apply back in the PowerBook and iBook days, but nowadays, the new machines really aren't that much faster, and that's kind of what you were alluding to, David, right?
That's absolutely right. I think you really have to run benchmarks to see real differences, or really sort of run a very high end application to see real differences between one and the other. And even if you do see a difference, suppose you're running a big Photoshop action and it takes 2 minutes to complete on the old machine, and it takes 1:50 or 1:40 to complete on the new machine. Well, how much is that 20 seconds worth to you? Is it worth $1,000? If it isn't, then save $1,000 and get the slightly older machine.
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, that's how I usually try to steer people: is get the used machine because, and I hate to say the word used because it doesn't really do it justice on what you're getting. But for the most, I think for most people, it's more than enough machine that they're going to need. And prices, $1,000 cheaper, that's not insignificant.
No, it's not. And, I wouldn't have been able to get that computer brand new. I mean, $2,500 that's a lot of money when you got two kids you're trying to raise.
Yeah, absolutely.
Exactly, especially with gas prices nowadays.
Yeah, no doubt. Fred, one of our longtime listeners, Fred, I think, has been listening to this podcast for over 3 years. I'm surprised that Fred's not brain damaged at this point, from Australia. He sent a nice little feedback about talking about some of these issues.
Yeah.
And one of them was why or why not buy one of the new machines. And I think I don't see that big of a significant difference between what I have, which is a 2 gigahertz, it's the first generation MacBook Pro.
Right.
And what the brand new machine is. I've looked at it. I thought, ooh, I kind of want that. But then I started really looking at the specs. I didn't really see a compelling reason for me to upgrade, because even to this day, my MacBook Pro does not feel slow.
No.
Ooh, I just rhymed there, didn't I?
Yeah. unless you're looking at like at least a 30% increase in power or productivity, it's not really worth it.
Well,
you may as well hold on to your money and wait.
It's not only not worth it, Guy. We can't perceive anything less than a 30% increase in speed in computer technology. That's a proven fact. If it's not at least 30% faster, we don't really see that much of a difference. Now, someone that's obviously doing motion pictures, with these huge work groups, they're going to see a difference in 20 or 10%. But for the average user, and even for some of the heavy hitters, less than 30%, you're just not going to really it's not noticeable. You're not going to notice a difference. No. Yeah.
Not unless you've got two machines side by side. And, you know, let's face it, you're very rarely in that sort of situation. And I think this is something we're going to have to get used to. I mean, when, you know, Fred mentioned in his email, you know, about you know, is this, what do we think about the new Intel CPUs and the movements of that? We have to understand that Intel, they invest a lot of money in developing these new chips, and then they push them out very, very quickly, much more quickly than we've been used to on the PowerPC platform. So these things are going to get revved every six to eight months quite easily. And you know, Intel, they want to sell new chips. They don't want to sell old chips, so they will cut off supply of the old processors.
Yeah, because so, he asked Fred in his email that there's rumors going around that Apple's going to bump them up once again in June, and do we agree with that? Yeah, absolutely, it's going to happen. That's pretty much a given. Intel really is, like you just said, David, you remember the PowerPC G5. How long were we waiting for a laptop with a G5 chip? And it never happened, but we were waiting forever.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, this is it, you know, and you've said this before, Tim. You should, if you need a machine today, you should go out and buy a machine today, and buy the machine you think you can afford. And if going to a refurb means you can get a better machine for the money, then go ahead and do that. I'm not a believer in waiting. I mean, as you know, I bought a MacBook the day before Macworld, I'm not a believer in waiting. If you want the machine and the machine is there and you've got the money to buy it, then go out and buy it. I mean, we've been talking on the staff list. I mean, old Rich Lefko is going on about iPod Touch. He's been talking ever since they launched the Touch that he wanted a 32 gig model rather than a 16 gig model because it wasn't big enough. And so now they've brought the 32 gig out, and he's saying, well, actually, I'd really like a 32 gig one with a slightly larger screen, so I'm going to wait till June or July. And, and you can just end up sitting there waiting to spend your money, and in the meantime, you have nothing. So
I went from a G5. Actually, I didn't go from it. That's the podcast studio here that I'm using right now. But I replaced that with a 2.8 gigahertz extreme, whatever, 24-inch iMac. So I went from a tower to an iMac. And a lot of people I told that to, they were like, why would you do that? That's, you know, you're going with a consumer machine. Because at this point in time, I really do believe that these iMacs are more power and more speed than most people are really going to need. Do you agree, Lee?
Yeah, I'm still amazed. I think it was you, Tim, who just said that. I still feel my computer still feels really fast. I mean, I bought the first generation Intel, MacBook,
that was me. Mm-hmm.
And all the applications I run on it, I run some heavy duty apps. I do a lot of encoding, I have lots of windows open, and I use spaces all the time now, and I'll have apps open all over the place. The computer does not feel slow to me. I mean, I have the 2.16, the Core Duo chip.
It's the same one I have in this 24-inch iMac.
The only thing I missed is I'm looking to upgrade. I just ordered a time capsule to do backups, and the one thing I did was I unscrewed, I think it was probably like 25 screws, but I replaced the AirPort Extreme card with the new. I got one for a Mac Pro.
Mm-hmm.
I stuck it in so I could do the 802.11n.
It's the same card, right?
Yeah, it's the same card. Just popped right in. Only took about 25 minutes to replace it. I miss little features like that because when I'm updating the Apple TVs, boy, I can't wait till I get to the 802.11n.
Yeah, it's going to be a lot faster.
So just little things like that are more important to me than processor speed.
Let me ask you a question about the Apple TV because I know you're a heavy user of them. Mm-hmm. And I'm looking at getting one myself. You said that you had a lot of movies on there, and that's why I sent you an email earlier, by the way. What was that? What was the program called?
The metadata editor?
Yes.
Meta-X?
Exactly, yes. Because I am actually ripping all my DVDs in the format for the Apple TV in anticipation of getting one.
Oh, excellent.
My question is, do the movies have to be in your iTunes after you sync it to the Apple TV, and do they have to stay there? Or if I remove them from iTunes, will they automatically delete from the Apple TV?
Well, it's kind of interesting. If you, I do a couple of different things. I keep my library of movies on an external drive. So I, when I copy into iTunes, I do an option copy so that it only copies the pointer to the location.
Path. Yes. The yes. Path.
So that keeps my MacBook hard drive.
That's exactly what I'm doing, by the way. I've got 160 gigabyte external FireWire drive, I think it's FireWire, on that machine.
Excellent.
And that's where I'm putting the movies, and that's where I'm going to sync it from to the Apple TV.
So with the one, you know, the 1.0 Apple TV software, I found out, you know, when I was at Macworld, we were gone for like 2 weeks on the West Coast. When I got back, one of my Apple TVs decided to go back to factory condition.
Wow, that's nice.
It just woke up and said, you need to reattach me and put all the software. I was like, oh, wait, where's all the content? But I was glad it was a smaller 40 gig one, so, you know, it didn't take too long. But I think the software, actually one of my developers today said that he thought that the version of macOS that's running on the Apple TV was Panther, actually, not even Leopard.
Wow.
So,
Panther?
Yeah, Panther. He went back a whole generation. So I was going to ask him how he, you know, who told him that. I was going to do a little more research on that. But the new Take-Two software seems to be a lot more stable and doesn't have a lot of problems when the computer that you have syncing to it doesn't have the like, if I don't have my external drive connected,
right?
It doesn't freak out and go, whoa, I got to start deleting. So for a little while, what I was doing is backing stuff up and then going into my folder directly and deleting stuff out of my folder. I found out that didn't do too well because every once in a while when it tried to do a sync, it would start getting a little lost and start removing stuff. But lately, with that Take-Two software, things have been pretty darn stable with the syncing.
I was curious about that from a personal reason, obviously, because I want to put a lot of movies on that. You kind of made me excited when you told me you had. How many movies did you say, like 80 or something?
Yeah, on the 160 gig one, we have over 100 now, 100 DVDs on
you
there.
You need to let me know exactly how you're encoding that, because my movies right now, using the new Handbreaker, coming at, 2.5 gigabytes, and I'm thinking, that's just, I'm not going to fit a whole lot of movies at 2.5 gigabytes each. How are you encoding them? What settings?
Well, I actually, I encode them for iPhone. And
okay.
It all depends. Right. What I recommend to people is encode it four or five different ways. Play them back on the Apple TV. Find the one you like the most.
Good idea.
I think the setting that, the preset for Handbrake, my tolerance for, you know, I'm not a, you know, I never considered myself an audiophile or a videophile. I just like technology. And coming from a streaming media background, you know, remembering back when I was streaming 80 kilobit per second video.
Yeah, and 13, you were impressed.
Yeah.
At 5 frames a second.
At 5 frames per second, I'm like, you know, 1,300 kilobits per second at 30 frames is pretty darn good to me. So I encode everything at 1350, and I let it fluctuate. So I average between 1,400 and 1,500 kilobits per second. And it looks perfectly fine on my 720p display. So it all depends on what the end output is. And
yeah, I kind of figure I'm going to do most of the movies that I really know I'm going to watch more than a few times at mm-hmm. the Apple TV setting, and then all the kid stuff and like that I'm probably going to do for the iPhone setting.
That's well,
Lee,
way to do it.
Lee, if you were
going
to buy one tomorrow, either the 40 or the 160, which one would you get?
If I bought one tomorrow, I'd buy the 40 and then upgrade the hard drive myself.
Really?
Yeah. You could buy, I mean, I just put a 250 gig, 2.5-inch drive in my MacBook Pro. I'm starting to see the 300s and 400 and 500 gigabyte 2.5-inch drives come out.
Yeah.
I've seen the 300s at OWC.
Yeah, you could, well, I would definitely buy a 40 refurb and drop in a, 320
good
or 400.
Idea.
Is there any hackery that you have to do for it to recognize the new drive or?
No, it's actually pretty easy. At the beginning, you know, people were doing things like doing disk images of the 40 and then mapping them. But
right.
Apple TV is pretty smart. Once the firmware is in, it knows what to do with a hard drive once it's installed.
Well, how did you get the firmware onto the new drive?
Oh, just running the iTunes. You do the update directly from the Apple TV. So you just tell it to update. It goes on the internet, updates its firmware, and then it's all set.
Awesome.
Oh, right. I'm going to do that because I'm going to buy one of those when I'm over in the States next month. So I think I'll follow that advice and pick up a refurb one and then
I think they're under 200,
myself.
Aren't they?
Yeah.
Yeah, the refurbs are. Absolutely.
Yeah, I think you get a refurb for like 209, 199, somewhere around there.
Amazing.
Anything else that we need to cover before we wrap up the show this week, guys?
There was just one other thing that Fred pointed out. So Fred's actually based in Australia. And so Steve Wozniak was over in Australia last week, and he made some comments about some of Apple's more recent activities, as well as saying that, you know, sometimes he has a conversation with Steve Jobs when he makes these comments, and sometimes Steve is cool with it, and sometimes Steve says, thanks for saying that, and sometimes he doesn't. So I just wondered if I could get you guys' views on what he said.
One of the things that he said is that he was disappointed with the the iPhone because
he
wasn't
3G. That's right. He was saying, well, he's got other 3G phones and he doesn't understand why Apple couldn't figure that out.
I think they were releasing it in the States with AT&T, and AT&T didn't have a big 3G network.
Well, that was really my feeling, and obviously when they came over here to Europe, where we have much more extensive 3G, everyone was wondering whether 3G would come here first.
Yep.
But I wonder really how much of a problem it is. I mean, I don't have, because I'm not on O2 here in the UK. I don't even have Edge. O2 is the only network that has Edge here, so I'm actually using it on GPRS, and it's not too bad. So I wonder whether it's a techie thing to lust after 3G and whether it's actually really necessary or not on a device like the Apple TV, iPhone. Like, yeah, but obviously when the SDK is available and all those apps are up there, then it may become more of an issue.
Yeah, and after I read Woz's comments, and a lot of the things that Woz said, you know, like the 24-hour rental window for rentals.
I agree with that.
And all those things are in the hands of they're Apple's partners, and it's really hard for them to, you know, I know AT&T is investing a lot of money this year to upgrade the 3G network, but Apple really has to, you know, trust their partners, and hopefully things get done quickly.
Do you think that these partners are kind of being a little crazy with Apple right now? I mean, Apple's got less than 500 movies to rent. They said they were going to have 1,000 by the end of February, and that's what Guy was talking about earlier. Do you think this is more of a partner problem with Apple, or because I can't imagine Apple's just sitting on this?
Well, you know, I have a little experience working when I was at Time Warner Cable, working on the video platform there, and working with content providers it's a tough thing. Sometimes lawyers are working out little nitty gritty things, and things just take a little longer than you thought. So you have these agreements, and you think you're really close to signing, and then all of a sudden, you know, there's one stickler.
Yep. One I would say thing. As well that
yep. sometimes I'd you feel like a nut.
I think as well that, you know, really the movie industry's been, the last few weeks, been rather distracted by this whole HD DVD thing, and I would imagine that that's probably been a factor as well.
That and counting all the money, because they actually made a ton of money last year. Everybody
that's true
assumes that the piracy is hurting the movie business. They made more money last year than they have. I don't know how long.
But without the piracy,
they certainly plead poverty enough.
Well, I don't know who to talk to about this, but I don't think it's necessarily a private or a piracy problem. It's always been, to me, a content problem. If the content that they're releasing sucked, I'm not going to the movies. But there's been some really good movies in 2007 and coming into 2008 that I did want to go see in the movie theater. I didn't want to wait till it to come out on DVD. And I think that's really the issue, don't you? Whoever.
Yeah, it's totally the issue. And you know, I happen to work for my parent company, is doing some interesting things now with New Line Cinemas now being going to be a part of Warner.
Yeah.
So, you know, those things, you know, losing the CEOs of New Line. And, you know, they brought some pretty good movies out, Lord of the Rings, Wedding Crashers. So it'll be interesting. I think there's some adjustment times for the movie industry. You know, it's going to take a little while to integrate New Line into Warner. So I think there's a lot of things going on, like David said. So we'll see.
Yep. Anything else that we should touch on?
Go ahead, Dave. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say the one other comment that Steve Wozniak made was the MacBook Air. He thinks it's a bit of a dud. He's not overly impressed.
Well, sales figures would contradict that opinion.
I agree with you on that, Tim. I think, you know, I mean, it really has had an awful lot of negative press saying, yeah, it's thin, but they've taken this out, they've taken that out of it, you can't check the battery and all this sort of thing, and I don't think any of that matters a jot. Yeah, whenever I go into the Apple, I was in London the other day, and I went to the big Apple store there on Regent Street, and they had quite a few out, and the desk where the MacBook Airs was mobbed, literally mobbed by people looking at it.
And
I think I think, well, they are. Yeah, quite literally they are. They have like this weird USB thing that goes in that that cries out if somebody pulls on it too hard.
But, They're stealing me!
I really think, you know, it is very much a Halo machine, just like the original iPod was. And if you remember back then, everyone said, oh, it's too expensive, it's the driver too small, why would anyone ever buy one of those? Yep. And I think the MacBook Air is a computing version of that. It's just one of those things where when people see it, they say, yeah, it's expensive, but it's just such a nice machine, I want to buy one. And I think that's why they are selling out.
Hey David, I think about 12 years ago, I was a K-12 SE for Apple's Southwest division selling to schools. And I remember bringing the iMac around, and I'm not joking, I used to hear people say, why isn't there a floppy drive on there? where's the serial ports? What's this USB thing? I think there's adjustment, and the iMac turned out to be, you know, the best-selling computer of all time for Apple. Yeah. So
still
I think
to
there's
this day.
A few of them.
Yep. A lot of people look at the shortcomings. I think the.
Uh-oh. And I just lost everybody on the show. I don't know if my network just went down. Let's see if I can ring them back in. It's kind of embarrassing right in the middle of a show. I lose everybody. And are you still there, Lee?
Yeah, hey, how's it going, Tim?
I lost everybody, and I'm all by myself on the podcast. I don't know what happened there, but... Everybody just kind of dropped off, and we got Guy back.
Hey, Guy.
Hey, David.
Hey, hello.
Now, that was kind of weird. All of a sudden, everybody said
connection lost.
And
yeah.
I'm still recording in GarageBand.
Oh, we can probably, I was going to say edit that out, but we don't do.
Not usually.
Yeah.
Let's wrap up the show with what's going on up at MyMac.com. You had something, Guy?
Yeah, one thing I wanted to talk about real quick. I got an email on this as well from one of the staffers about a pro. Now, everybody knows I'm like the iWeb guy of the site, and there's a new program from Zara Studios, ZaraStudios.com, called iWeb Buddy. It lets you manage multiple domains in your RSS feeds and use Google Analytics and the social bookmarking, you know, all the stuff that iWeb doesn't do that well. And it looks to be kind of an interesting program. I'm talking to the developer right now, and he's going to send me a copy. And I'm going to try it out, and eventually I will let you guys know how it works.
Wow,
very interested in that.
Yeah, $25 is a pretty good deal.
Yeah.
Up on the website, John Nemirovsky reviewed I think one of the worst product names I've seen in years, the iMuffs headphones. Oh, no. iMuffs. That's a name.
Ow, wow.
That's a product name right there.
I'm feeling shaggy carpet right now for some reason.
Yeah, I don't know. So am I. Or one of those egg chairs that you would see on Mark and Mindy. Something like that. that's what you'd sit in listening to your iMuffs. David Weeks did a review of the Book of Wireless. Roger Bourne reviewed, the Kindle from Amazon. That's kind of interesting.
Yeah, it was interesting, yeah.
I'm still interested in seeing where the Kindle ends up going. I think this is a first-gen product that I have zero interest in, spending that much money for something that does nothing all by itself.
Yeah.
But I said the same thing about the iPod. I don't see – I did. You don't know this, Lee, but I actually – when
slammed
the iPod was first released, I slammed it, said as soon as Sony gets into this market, Apple's dead.
Wow.
So what do I know? But I don't see the Kindle burning up sales, do you? I don't know anybody who owns one.
It's still sold out all the time, though, isn't it? I mean, I check the website every now and again. I showed my I've got the Sony Reader, the PRS505, which is the same sort of device. It doesn't have the wireless interface of Amazon that the Kindle has. I showed it to my father, who's really not remotely technical. So I showed it to him a couple of weeks ago, and he was absolutely captivated by it. He's a big reader, and you know, he has bookshelves absolutely heaving full of books, and you know, he does struggle with he's obviously always traveling back and forth between here and Florida, and he does struggle with keeping up with his book reading when he's traveling, and he was really interested in the Sony Reader. He'd not seen it before, so I suspect I'll be putting that on his birthday list.
Sony Reader or the Kindle?
The Sony Reader. I did talk to him about the Kindle. The problem is that you know, you need to have a US credit card to be able to buy a Kindle. Because of the licensing restrictions on the books,
sure.
That's going to be a problem.
Oh yeah, the DRM.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Roger gave it a 4 out of 5, and he seems to like it. It's just nothing that I'm really interested in right now. Artie reviewed the music behind, or I'm sorry, the Music Bandit retractable stereo headphones. They're actually earphones. Do you guys like earphones? Do you prefer like headphones over the ear or surrounding the ear type of headphones?
I've got the Etymotics, which go right in my ears. But I know you hate that, Tim.
I hate those.
I like them because they really do seal all the sound out. So you know, they're good for me. But I do admit they are a bit of acquired taste, and obviously you can't ever share them because they're always covered in your personal earwax.
What about you, Lee? Do you like the inner ear ones or the actual headphones?
Well, I used to be a big fan of the Quiet Comfort 2s. But the problem I had was, you know, I needed something in the car, or I needed something
portable.
Something portable. So I bought the V-Moda ones that are iPhone compatible. And the weirdest thing, I can't, like at lunch sometimes I'll watch a TV show. I could hear myself chew. So... I find, I don't know, it's something to get used to. So this is the first time I've ever bought in-ear earphones, so I'm still getting used to it.
Yeah, I can't get used to them. I've tried. I just reviewed the JBL Reference 510 headphones. I gave it a 4 out of 5.
Oh, great.
There were some problems with them, and I write that in the review. The first pair that I received, the left side completely blew out within a few days. And this is not me rocking out some Metallica at full blast at 1,000 decibels. I mean, this is just normal listening. But both JBL and the company that we got it from, you know, they everybody was like, oh, no, that's Dr. Bot said that they've never had one returned to them. So I didn't take that into too much consideration in the overall review, but I thought I really do have to mention something like that. When they blow out and I'm a product reviewer, I kind of got to talk about that a little bit. David, you did a messenger bag.
Yeah, it's quite a nice bag, actually. It's a fetching prune color. But yeah,
does that go with your personality at work, or
I've been using it for a while now because when I'm doing bags, I really like to use them for a fair bit to give them a really good review, you know, to make sure the quality is up to scratch and everything. So nobody's commented on my prune bag. The only really negative thing I found about it was that the purple coloring actually would rub off on the white accessories if they were inside the bag.
Oh wow!
So once it's on there, you couldn't get it off. So that was one thing I did have to, I did feed that back to the manufacturer as well, and so that's something they need to look at. Now I don't know whether that's just a one-off example with my particular one or not. But
did you get any response from them?
They said they were looking into it, and that was the last I heard. But generally, you know, it's very well designed. It's very well put together. I mean, it's not flimsy like some of the cheaper bags on the market. So if you like that particular style and you don't want to carry that much stuff with you, it's probably a good way to go.
I kind of like the purple color. It's kind of neat looking.
Yeah.
John Nemo, if you've got small children at home, young children, and they want to learn how to play guitar, John Nemo reviewed the eMedia My Guitar. They actually sent that to me, too, at the same time that they sent it to John. I didn't ask this, you know, I don't send me stuff unless I request it. That's kind of my policy because companies tend to just drop ship me stuff every time they release a new product, which maybe for the average listener out there, you think that would be cool. But after a while, and your wife is getting really sick of the UPS truck pulling up 3 or 4 times a week with products, she's like, this is getting a little ridiculous. But eMedia sent this My Guitar. I haven't even looked at it other than the box, but it looked interesting. So I was surprised to see a review from John pop up. And he gave it a 4 out of 5. So if you've got young ones and they want to learn how to play guitar, this might be a good solution. Anybody here got a guitar that you want to teach a young one?
Well, I tried to play guitar when I was a kid, but I switched over and got the eMedia piano software. So I'd love to learn how to play guitar again.
My fingers just don't. I can type really well. I can play video games, so I'm very Guitar Hero. I can rock on, but when it comes to an actual guitar, my fingers they have a mind of their own. They do not go where
you need
I
a wider.
Want to.
You need a wider neck.
Yeah, I need a bigger fretboard.
Yeah.
Owen Rubin did a review of the HP PhotoSmart A26 snapshot photo printer. I don't know if the name could possibly be any longer. It's, but it looks kind of like an ATM, and he says that in his review. It's just kind of this egg shapeish. It's kind of odd looking, but he gave it a 3.5 out of 5, so that's an average score. I don't think you'd have to shy away from it, but there might be some other stuff on the market that you want to look at before that.
Yeah, there's a good review he did though. It was very comprehensive and lots of pictures. Yeah, so it really gives you a good view of the product.
Gil Polson, who we're going to have on the podcast here pretty soon because he's obviously new at MyMac.com. He's probably the only person that I know that can put Lee's Mac collection to shame.
Oh my, we gotta beat him.
he's got an actual museum in his basement, so when we get him on the show, we definitely have to have you on the same show, Lee.
Excellent.
And we should talk about that for a second. Last week we had you back on the show because you were so fun to talk to the week before when you did the AOL interview, and here you are for the third week in a row. So we should probably announce that you're pretty much going to be a regular on the show now.
Yeah, I love talking about Mac stuff, and I used to, you know, people around Gaithersburg used to see me at the old CompUSA just standing around in the Apple section just talking to people about Macs. It's a fun thing for me.
Well, thanks for coming on the show every week, Lee. We really do appreciate it, and it's fun talking to you, man.
Sure, thanks a lot.
Get back to Gil for a minute. He did a review of an Apple Training Series, Mac OS X Support Essentials, second edition. It's a book. It's really a book that's designed to get you through the Apple certification process. And if you take it with that in mind when you buy this book, he gives it a very high rating. But if you kind of give it a looking at other books that's going to help you repair your Mac or get to know your Mac, he gives it a very low rating, which is kind of strange. It's a 4.5 if you're looking to get Apple certified, but as a general purpose Mac OS 10.5 introduction, he gives it a 1 out of 5. So, you know, make sure you know what you're buying before you buy it, because, you know, just because it looks like it's going to teach you Mac OS doesn't necessarily mean that's the right book for you. So I think that's probably the important thing to take from that review. And lastly, on the feature side, John Nemo interviews is Quincy Carroll. He's the CEO of iPlay Music. That was a fun interview. I like that. I love it when we do text interviews, and we've been doing that since our first year of publishing back in 1995. I did an interview, I remember, with David Pogue via email. And so we're continuing doing these text interviews. I think it's important. I think it's fun, and it's a good way to learn about new products and some of the people that's behind these products.
Excellent.
So, Lee.
Yes.
You've actually got a couple blog posts up at mymac.com, one about AIM on the iPhone and the OpenAIM 2.0.
Yeah, I'm also going to start taking a look at some of the open source apps that I use a lot for encoding and, trying to share as much information I can to get everybody to go out and buy an Apple TV because I just love the product.
Yeah, me too. At least I hope I will. I love the fact that I might be getting one. Let me put it that way. But then again, I'm already encoding some video, so it's a good bet.
Excellent.
I posted Sam Levin of, you heard him at the beginning of the show, it's Cool Mac Picks, his Casemate Signature Series review. It's a YouTube video, so check that out. There's a lot more stuff up there, and I think we need to wrap it up because this is probably one of the longest shows that we've done in a very, very long time. It's going to run close to... geez, almost 2 hours. So let's wrap this up. For David, Lee, and Guy, I'm Tim Robertson. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for downloading the MyMac.com podcast. You can subscribe to this podcast at our RSS feed at MyMac.com or by visiting the iTunes Music Store's podcast section. Please send all feedback to MyMacPodcast@gmail.com. And thanks for listening to the MyMac.com podcast.